But when Linda and I went to Romania, we brought a briefcase full of documents with us to prove that we were doctors and that we said we were who we said we were, because we knew we would need those documents in order to eventually get licenses to practice medicine in Romania. It took us 2 years for the government to approve our diplomas from medical school. Actually, that sounds like a long time, but miracles were done along the way to make it even happen then. And then we went to the Ministry of Health with our diplomas, and they said, oh, well, as soon as you're citizens, you can get a license to practice medicine. And that turned out to be another 5 years, and there were miracles on the way that made that happen even after a total of 7 years. So the idea for Jesus Credentials came to me. We brought all these documents to prove who we said we were, that we were doctors. And I thought to myself, Jesus brought a lot of documents. He brought a lot of credentials with him when he came to prove that he is who he says he is, that he is the Son of God, the living Son of the living God. And notice I said is, because Jesus wasn't just was, he is, and he is forever. And you already knew that, but let's talk about it. When we left Minnesota, I felt like we were still living in the age of reason, but maybe they call it the postmodern age. We came back here to Washington State. If I was a world-known historian, I would name it now that we are now living in the age of confusion. Jeff's father-in-law, Gary, talked about confusion. There's falsehood, there's lies, there's deceptions, there's fake news. It's around us all the time. And you just can't escape it, and it's really frustrating. And how do you fight confusion and falsehood and lies? With truth. I'm going to go back real briefly to 3,000 years ago when David was facing Goliath. He went to the stream and he got 5 smooth stones, and just with one of them, he defeated Goliath. Well, we have enemies now. They're not Goliath or Philistine giants. Some of our enemies are deception and confusion, falsehood. And we don't use 5 smooth stones from a stream. We're going to have to use 5 smooth stones of truth. And I want to compare 5 smooth stones of truth to 5 credentials, 5 of the credentials that Jesus brought with him today. And these smooth stones of truth, they're to be used against falsehood. They're not to be used against other human beings, other people. They're to be used against falsehood. They're not to be used to argue religion with people. I don't know that, I'm probably wrong, but I personally don't know anybody that's ever been argued into the kingdom. So what are the 5 credentials that I want to talk about today? The ones that, to me, prove that he is who he says he is. Well, obviously, the first one is miracles, and he did so many miracles that John said take jillions of megabytes to write down all the things that Jesus did. I'm exaggerating a little. The next is, and miracles are being done in his name today. They've been done for the last 2,000 years in his name. The next is his teachings, and I grew up in a Christian home, and I thought I knew a lot about Jesus, but it was even after I saw some miracles that I started to realize how wonderful Jesus' teachings are. I'm going to give you just one example. And then there's answered prayer and fulfilled prophecy. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but they are definitely ways that Jesus proves that he is who he says he is. And then change lives. And boy, that's a huge one. Everybody's life should be changed by Jesus. I said 5 smooth stones. Well, there's also this extra credit. Call it his super miracle, the resurrection. So let's talk about the first miracle. I was raised in a Christian home, and I had this really strong faith as a child. And then I went off to college, and it was a church college, but it was a very liberal church college. And even in the 60s, they were teaching that the Bible is not true. And also, some people were saying God is dead, and even though the professors didn't say that God is dead, they didn't say that he wasn't dead either. And that really undermined my childhood faith, and my personal life went downhill for the next 15 years. In fact, at the end of those 15 years, I was going through a divorce. But then some things started to happen in my life that helped me to get my faith back. And it was obviously that faith is even stronger than it was when I was a little kid. And it's especially with these five truths that I now know that Jesus is alive and that he is who he says he is. I got hit with a lie, but then back in 1980, I got hit with a really big truth, but it didn't change my life right away. I moved to after internship and medical school, I moved to a small town in western Minnesota. It was on the prairie, and people that lived on the hill lived 6 feet above the rest of the town. By that time, my faith was gone. I really loved the people. I spent 10 years there. And just before I was about ready to leave that town, there was a Christian family that had adopted three children from South America, a 2-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 10-year-old. And the 2-year-old was as cute as could be, smart as could be, learned English really, really fast. And when the little kid was 2 years, 9 months old, the mom wanted to run some errands in town. It was a town of 3,000 people, so she said, I'll be back. She left the kid off at grandma's house and said, I'll be back in an hour. When she came back an hour later, the little girl was pointing at the back door, pointing up, and the mom saw her own mother, grandma, laying on the kitchen floor, and she didn't know what had happened, and so she walks in and she says, oh, are you playing games with grandma? And the little girl says, and this is a quote, 2 years, 9 months old, no, not to worry. Grandma is dead. Jesus came down from upstairs and told me not to worry, that he was taking grandma upstairs with him. That was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. My mom called me right away, and the ambulance. We came right away. The grandmother was laying on the floor, dead. A pan of macaroni spilled next to her. The water was still on in the sink. The gas was still on in the stove. And the little girl was walking around real nonchalantly doing what Jesus told her to do, not to worry. So I remember right then and there in that kitchen, I think this little girl knows more than those professors at college. I did all my doctor stuff, and I went home to my empty house because I was going through a divorce. I made my supper, and I'm sitting on the couch an hour later, and you talk about a light going on in your head. I remembered my children's stories, my Bible stories from Sunday school. I said, what does the angel always say? Fear not, not to worry. What would you tell a little kid nowadays if you were Jesus? No, not to worry. And what did the little girl say? No, not to worry. Grandma's dead. Jesus came down from upstairs and told me not to worry, that he was taking grandma upstairs with him. I can't make up that story. From that moment on, I knew that Jesus is alive. That was April 1980. But my life did not change. It didn't change my life at all in any other way. I knew Jesus was alive, but he didn't become my Lord. It took another 3 years before that would happen. That 1980, I was in the small town a year later. In April of 1981, I went to Minneapolis and I applied for a job at a clinic, and that's where I met Linda. I liked her right away. I got the job, and 2 years later, I got the girl. She was a Christian. She was a fairly new Christian, and thankfully she hadn't read the Bible as thoroughly as Jeff wants us to read, because there's this Bible verse about do not be unequally yoked. And so we married, and she had taken me to some churches, and so 8 days after we married, she said, I'll show you a church even you will like, and she dragged me to this church, and I really liked it. The pastor said, put God first. No, he said, if things aren't right in your life, it's because your priorities aren't right. Well, things are a lot better for me now as a newlywed with Linda than they had been for a long time. And he said, if things aren't right in your life, put God first in your life and see what will happen. And I said, that kind of makes sense. I think I'll do that. And I remember thinking, in that week, boy, I sure hope Linda wants to go back to that church, because if she doesn't want to go, I'm going to have to drag her. True story. So that's when my life really began to change. I started telling people about my story, and they'd tell me stories back. I especially like stories by children. I've told this story to a lot of people, and sometimes they tell me a story kind of like that. I have at least 12 stories by adults. Patients and other people have told me stories about miracle stories, about seeing Jesus. I also have at least six by children. I'm going to share two more by kids, because especially kids don't have any hidden agenda. One of the first stories that got told to me, I call my Roman Catholic story. When I moved to Minneapolis, I got a job at that clinic, and even before I was a Christian, before I had become a believer, I told that story about the little girl, and the nurses told me a story back. And they said there was another little girl who was 3 years old who went to another branch office of the same clinic where I was working. And when she was 3 years old, the mom found her floating face down in their backyard family swimming pool. And she called 911 right away, and the ambulance came, and I know they got her breathing again. I know they didn't know if she was going to live or die, or whether she was going to have brain damage or whatever, but eventually she recovered completely and was back to being a normal little girl. I don't know the details of that part real well. I don't know how long it took her, but the next part I know really, really well, like word for word. So it was a Roman Catholic family, and the mom, the little girl was 6 years old and spunky as could be, and the mom was telling her about First Communion. And the little girl said, well, I don't need that. And the mom said, well, yeah, you do. And the little girl said, well, no, I don't. And the mom said, yeah, you do, and they went back and forth. And then the mom said, well, why do you say that? And the little girl said, well, I've already seen Jesus. And she said, remember when you were in the backyard screaming and hollering and waving your arms and Jesus was holding me and he put me back in your arms? Don't you remember that? Jesus is alive. I'm pretty sure the little girl got her first communion, but anyway, Jesus is alive. I had no hidden agenda. She just thought everybody saw that. I've got one more story. It's about a girl, a little kid, but it was told to me by a woman 50 years later. I had become a Christian by then. I was making rounds on a Saturday morning at the hospital in Minneapolis and covering for several of the other doctors in our clinic. And one of the patients was an 80-year-old lady, a woman who was breathing on oxygen. She couldn't even talk. And her daughter was in the room, and she wanted to talk to me. And I told Linda I was going to be home by 11 to help her get ready for an outreach that we were doing for our small group. And I wasn't real happy to have to talk to this lady until I saw that she had this huge leather-bound Bible under her arm, and she was smiling from ear to ear, in spite of her mother being sick and dying. So we went in another room, and the lady said, I have to tell you about my mother. She has been a prayer warrior all her life. And way back in the 30s, when she was a young woman, she had prayed to have a baby, to have a child. She had had 6 pregnancies, and she had lost all the pregnancies, all the children, including my twin sister, and I was the only one who was still alive. It was in Tennessee. It was in the Depression in the 30s. We were really, really poor. And I was 5 years old. It was wintertime, and I had had 2 bouts of double pneumonia. This is before antibiotics. I had had 2 bouts of double pneumonia, and the second time the doctors had pronounced me dead. The nurses and doctors were taking me out into the hallway to take me down to the morgue. I was covered with a sheet, and my mother would not let me go. She believed, she knew that I was God's answer for her prayer to have a child. And she would not let me go. She was just holding onto the cart in my body as hard as she could. She said, in the meantime, the lady said, I was standing at a riverbank, and Jesus was standing in front of me between me and the river. And he was telling me that I had to go back and be with my mother. And then suddenly, she said, I sat up, and she made a motion like she was throwing off a sheet. And I shouted, "Let me go," and startled all the nurses and the doctors in the hallway, of course. She said, "Nowadays," she says, "I was so well from that time on that probably today they would have let me go home from the hospital that same day." But even more important, she said, "You have to understand that I was saying, 'Let me go,' to my own mother, because the love in Jesus' eyes is so amazing, so wonderful, that I wanted to be with him instead of with my very own mother." And I didn't see the woman ever again. Her mother died that night. And it just dawned on me last night as I'm thinking about the sermon today, that woman, that 80-year-old woman, she died, but that's also the same day that she got to see Jesus and she got to see her other 5 babies forever and ever. I've sometimes been a little afraid to tell all these stories. You think, "Oh, this place sounds so wonderful. I want to go there now." Stay here until God says, "No, seriously, some people, I don't know." I could talk miracles, 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 but we have to move on. So what's the next? His teachings. And I thought I knew a lot about Jesus when I was a kid. I went to Sunday school, did Lutheran confirmation. And I can't even begin to tell how wonderful his teachings are in just one morning. But a light went on in my head again when I moved to Minneapolis. I said I left that town in 1980, the small town. I didn't move right to Minneapolis. My midlife crisis wasn't to buy a fancy new sports car or have an affair. My midlife crisis was to go to Norway and Europe and do a whole bunch of cross-country ski races all winter long. And when I came back, I got the job at the clinic where I met Linda. And there was also another woman there who was Mrs. Minnesota. She was really proud of being, you know, of Norwegian heritage, and she was also a Christian. And she gave me the Lord's Prayer calligraphied in Norwegian in the shape of a cross. And I knew Norwegian from my parents talking to each other in Norwegian or Swedish when I was a little kid, when they didn't want their little kid to know what they were talking about. It's amazing how much I learned. So I'm translating it back for for the nurses, Linda's nurse and my nurse. And I got to, "And give us this day our daily bread." Light goes on in the head. It doesn't say, "Give me a brand new car or a college education for my kids." It doesn't say me. It says, "Give us." And it says, "What we need daily, not what we want forever and ever." And trusting in him. And I thought, sharing. And then I got to the very next petition, and it says, "And forgive us our trespasses, our sins, as we forgive those who trespass against others." I said, sharing and forgiving. What problems would we human beings have if we would just do those things? I mean, as humans, we wouldn't have human problems. We still have earthquakes and hurricanes and diseases and all those kinds of things. But even those things would be easier to deal with if we would just share and forgive. And I thought to myself, maybe this Jesus really is who he says he is. I really honestly, MD stands for mighty dumb. It took me a real long time to get there. But I remember thinking, boy, this guy's really smart. Humans don't think like that. Since that time, I've added one more thing to sharing and forgiving, and that's being honest, telling the truth, especially if in this age of deception and confusion. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the next thing, answered prayer, because there's not a lot of time. But it's a huge topic. Jeff and the rest of us could have sermon after sermon about prayer, and I know Jeff wants to emphasize prayer even more when he comes back. Of all the different truths that we're going to talk about today, I think this is probably the one where a lot of people have more questions than anything else. I can't answer them all. I know that people say, "Well, God didn't answer my prayer." and they're really upset. Well, God answers prayer. Even people who have lost children, they will get to see those children in heaven. I went to a sermon one time by a woman who was talking about human suffering and the image of the Father. She said, people sometimes say that a child, God saw that child's was so beautiful that he took it for himself. He said, that doesn't comfort, that is not true. Death took that loved one away. Jesus took that loved one away from death. Whether that loved one is 2 days old or 100 years old, Jesus takes us away from death. So even those kinds of prayers, those are selfish prayers. I always pray to keep people alive. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit, though. There was a study done, published in the Southern Medical Journal. It's a miracle that a study on prayer would get published. A cardiologist did a study where he had a whole bunch of people in the coronary care unit over time with heart attacks or myocardial infarctions. And he was a Christian, and he had some born-again believers pray for half the patients and not pray for the other half. And it was a well-done study. The people didn't actually go to the hospital and pray for the people. They stayed in their homes, but they prayed for half the patients and not the other half. And it was a well-done study, and the results were very dramatic, the statistical analysis. Nobody lived or died. There was no difference in who lived or died in the statistics, but as far as complications and outcomes, the odds of the complications being less than the people who were prayed for, the odds that they could be by chance was less than 1 in 100. The p-value is 0.01 for your 2% of people who like statistics. And the odds of the outcomes being just by chance were less than 1 in 1,000. No well-done study is going to get anybody to agree on the role of healing, prayer and healing in this culture. And indeed, there was another study that came out around the same time that got published, and it showed no difference whatsoever in people who had been prayed for and people who had not been prayed for. But there was a slight difference in the study. In that study, you didn't have to be a born-again Christian. You could be anything at all to be one of the people who was praying for the patients. So maybe I'm being facetious. There were two prayers from my childhood. I think children are better prayers than we are. I remember two prayers from my childhood, and I remember them because they were really, really, really important to me. The first was my mother had tuberculosis. This was 1953. I was 8 years old. She was really sick. She was in a hospital a couple hundred miles away. You feel sorry for the poor little Hansen kid. He got to see my mother for 10 minutes through a window at Christmas time in those 13 months. Don't feel too sorry for me. Every little old lady in the town brought me cookies and desserts, and I weighed 60 pounds when she went in, and I weighed 90 pounds when she came out. I think my mother said, that's not my kid. I remember praying, oh, please, dear God, keep my mother alive. Please, 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 don't let her die. I didn't know at the time that the doctor sat down with my father and said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your wife has 2 years to live max, and she's going to be a semi-invalid that whole time. That was 1953. 1986, my mother was still alive, 33 years later. And Linda and I and my kids are out for dinner after church, and my mother's a very, I don't know, type of person. And she opens up her purse. She opens up her purse and she shows me this newspaper clipping. It's the obituary of the doctor who told my dad that she had 2 years to live. She couldn't show it to my dad because he had already died as well. Then I had one other prayer, and it was that I remember. It was about the Iron Curtain. And it was, please, dear God, do something about the Iron Curtain. A pastor had come to our church. He is a Czech from Czechoslovakia. He had escaped the communists. This was 1953 again. And he was talking about how he and other Christians were being tortured in communist prison camps behind the Iron Curtain. That was the barrier, the wall between Eastern Europe and communist countries and the Western countries. And I remember thinking, I was so afraid of the communists, the Russians, everybody was. And I remember saying, please, dear God, do something about the Iron Curtain. I had no idea whatsoever what God could do about the Iron Curtain. We were afraid that the Russians were going to take over the whole world. And I'm not kidding. We really were. So that was my prayer. Well, the Iron Curtain did come down, and it came down with a crash in 1989. And not only that, but in 2004, Linda and I were in Romania, and we were in Liberty Square in Bucharest, and we were in some bleachers, and three rows in front of us was President Bush, and he was inviting Romania to NATO. Did God do something about the Iron Curtain? Jeff, when I talked about this, he said, some of those people don't even know what the Iron Curtain is. So, anyway. Okay, next is fulfilled prophecy. I am not an expert on fulfilled prophecy. Jesus fulfills all the messianic prophecies about him in the Old Testament. They're not about anybody else. The Jews thought that Jesus, the Messiah, was going to come and he was going to save his people from the Romans. They knew the Messiah was going to come. They forgot. They didn't understand that he was coming to save his people from their sins, as the angel told Joseph when he told Joseph to name Jesus Jesus. Anyway, I'm not an expert. I'm going to give you the name of a guy named Josh McDowell. He's written several books. The one that is easy to read is about the resurrection and Jesus being Lord, called More Than a Carpenter, with 10 truths about Jesus. And he's also written several other books. The most best known are Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's thorough, about all kinds of Old Testament prophecy and how it applies to Jesus, and then the New Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Josh McDowell, I met when I did my very first mission trip to Moscow in 1992. And when he was a young man, he was having an argument with some Christians in his college, and he said, I'll prove to you that the Bible isn't true, and he spent the next year and a half doing research to prove that the Bible wasn't true. And he became convinced after a year and a half time that the Bible was true, and it changed his life completely. He especially became convinced that the resurrection is a historical fact. Josh McDowell. Okay, now the next one. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I got to share one fulfilled prophecy story with you, though. It's Psalm 22. It's written by David 1,000 years before Jesus was on earth, and it starts out, my God, who, why have you forsaken me? I'm sure all of you know that that's one of the words that Jesus said on the cross. And later on in Psalm 22, it says, a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet, just like nails in your hand. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. Just like Jesus' crucifixion 1,000 years later. Rome, when David wrote this psalm, Rome wasn't even a village, much less an empire. And crucifixion hadn't been invented by the Romans yet. So the next is changed lives. And this is really big. And it applies to the disciples and several other believers 2,000 years ago, and it applies to our life today. There's Peter, Thomas, and this funny name, Punaswamy Swamidos. We'll get there. And many, many more. I'm going to talk about two disciples. First is Peter. We all know the story about how Peter, when the night that Jesus was arrested, before that, Peter said, oh, I'm never going to betray you. I'm never going to deny you. And Jesus said, well, yes, you are. In fact, by tomorrow morning, before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times. And I used to think, and indeed, Peter, the third time that night that he denied Jesus, he swore, I don't even know that man. And I used to think that was a story about how smart Jesus is. And it is. But it's even more a story about how Peter's life changed in the next 50 days. Actually, it changed in the next 3 days. At Pentecost, after Jesus' resurrection and ascension, and the Holy Spirit comes down in really amazing and powerful ways at Pentecost, 50 days after the after Easter, Peter gets up and preaches a sermon, and 3,000 people become followers of Jesus Christ. The word Christian hadn't even been invented yet. So what's the difference? Well, Jesus was crucified. They put him in a tomb. And on the third day, Easter Sunday morning, the women went to the tomb to prepare his body, and the tomb was empty. And they ran to the disciples, and Peter and John ran back to the tomb. And like they said, it's empty. And then Jesus appeared to them more than once, several times, probably more than it's even recorded in the Bible. And from Pentecost that day on, you could not shut Peter up. The man that said, "I don't even know the man," you couldn't shut him up. The only way you could shut him up is when the Romans crucified him decades later, I think in the early 60s, in Rome. And they Peter begged not to be crucified like Jesus. He begged to be crucified upside down, because he didn't think he deserved to be crucified in the same way as Jesus. Changed life. And then there's Thomas. We always know about Doubting Thomas. Well, Linda and I got blessed with a really good story about Thomas. That name, Punaswami Swamidos, when we went to Romania in 1994, our very first job was with World Vision. This is before we had licenses, and we were busy right away. We first worked with World Vision, and then we built a clinic. And it's interesting, but the clinic where we wanted to take care of patients and train Romanian doctors, we finally got the last permit to open up the clinic the same week that we got our licenses to practice medicine after 7 years, 9 months. Anyway, so our first job was with World Vision, and it was to help upgrade the curriculum of the medical school in Cluj, which is in Transylvania, which is a beautiful place, and there really aren't any werewolves there. And one of the things we were supposed to do was bring five different specialists from the United States to work with different departments of the medical school in Romania for about 3 weeks. And one of them, my colleague, the professor I was working with, the Romanian, really wanted me to hire this Dr. Punaswami Swamidos, who is a professor of public health in the United States. And I said, I thought to myself, I didn't say this, I don't want to hire a Hindu. And Dr. Bokshan, my colleague, just really thought the world of Swamidos, and he just really wanted him. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll call, but maybe he can't come. And so I called, and immediately, this very gracious South Asian voice said, "Romania. Somebody from my church just came back from Romania." He said, "Church, not temple." Swami and his wife came. They got off the plane within minutes. I said, "This is one of the most saintly men I have ever met." He and his wife are from the southern tip of India. They met when they were young at a private Christian school. She was from the very highest social class. He wasn't. It was even against Christian Indian social norms to get married across classes then. But she recognized his character, and they got married. And that may be one reason why they didn't stay in India, but he ended up in the United States as a professor. She is from the very highest social class in India. And Swami said she can trace her ancestry back to one of the first 31 families brought to Jesus Christ by Thomas in writing. With a big smile, he said, "There are also Hindu writings from the first century in his part of India that say, stay away from those followers of Jesus and Thomas." And then also, there's a cornerstone on a Hindu temple that says something like, I don't have the quote quite right, "We had to move our village and build our temple here because Thomas defiled our village." I think he went there. I think he did see Jesus. This is from John, verse or chapter 20. This is what happened between Thomas and Jesus. Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hands in his side, I will not believe it. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." We kind of make fun of doubting Thomas. I don't make fun of him. I didn't believe until this little girl said, "No, not to worry. Grandma's dead. Jesus came down from upstairs and told me not to worry." That's almost as good as putting your hands in his side. Jesus has given me all kinds of credentials that he is alive, that he is who he says he is. He does these wonderful miracles. His teaching are just amazing about how, not only how he wants us to live, but he also teaches us how we can be with him forever. He answers prayer, he fulfills prophecy, and he definitely changes lives. He's changed my life so many ways, and I want him to change it even more. We haven't talked about it, but Jesus did lots of parables, and just when I was thinking about this talk, I came up with my very own parable, and it's about changed lives, and it's called... It's called the Parable of the Seahawks. And Jeff and John and my wife are either going like this or, oh my goodness, okay. There's this team called the Seahawks. I fell in love with Jesus 36 years ago. I fell in love with the Seahawks when they came here. And I just love the fact that they won the Super Bowl. Well, this is the next season. This is the next year's Super Bowl. This is my favorite play ever, ever.
Russell in the pocket. Russell for Carson. It's broken up again. And is it, but somehow, did he wind up with a football?
I think Butler hit it and it fell right back down to the ground. Unbelievable. That's exactly what happened, isn't it?
Well, Curse goes for it. It's still not on the ground. It's still not on the ground. It's still, well, look at that.
Oh, my God. I can't believe he didn't get up and get in the end zone in time.
I am not a jealous, covetous person. My only good sport ever in high school, and I wasn't even good at that, was football, and I sat on the bench the whole time. My wife knows I exaggerate. I'm going to do it. I think about this play, I think, oh, if I could have been the guy to do that play, I could have, like, been the only play I ever did to make that catch. I would have worked 50 years in a communist prison camp in Siberia if I could have just done that play. Okay, so remember when they won?
Play clock at 5.
This is a parable.
Pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler. Unreal. Malcolm Butler, who almost made the phenomenal play that wound up in Percy's arms. There are flags on the field for a celebration.
So what does that have to do with Jesus? So what does that have to do with Jesus or anything else? Well, Paul, who also became a believer, wrote Romans, and in Romans 10:9, I get it mixed up, maybe it's 10:9 or 9:10. He says, "Because if you believe with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved." Now, I'm going to paraphrase that. Because if you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, that Jesus is alive. I knew that from April 1980, that Jesus is alive. And you confess him with your mouth that Jesus is Lord. I didn't do that until August 1983. You will be saved. And the parable, it's comparing the fantastic play, that touchdown, no score. If Marshawn Lynch had got the ball on that two plays later, maybe they would have scored. But it didn't happen. So all those miracle stories, if Jesus isn't your Lord, if that doesn't change your life, there's no victory. And it was finally when Jesus became my Lord in August 1983, when Linda dragged me to that church, that's when my life changed. That's when I had the victory. So that's my Seahawks parable. I'm sorry that I showed you the second place. My blood pressure went up to 170 over something. I kid you not. The last playoff, this last one in January of this year, when they didn't make the playoff, I went into atrial fibrillation in the fourth quarter. Okay, so I'm going to ask the worship team to come up. So you know that Jesus is alive, and hopefully he's your Lord. And I suspect that for everybody in this room that's true, but if it's not, he can become your Lord. I know that I'd be very happy to stay up here. Jeff would be very willing to pray with you. It's not hard to ask Jesus to be your Lord. He will obviously let you be his Lord. And you will not be bored. You will be blessed. We would be very happy to help you learn how to follow him, to learn more about his teachings. And he wants us to live the life that God planned for us, each one of us, on earth, and also with him forever and ever. He is just wonderful. And put God first in your life and see what will happen. I'm seeing it right this moment. And a little bit of hint. Adventure is a really good name for a church. It's a lot better than safe and comfortable churches. Thank you very much.